Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host, and each week we scour the internet looking for interesting new books, and we interview the authors of those books. And this week I'm very happy to say we have Edmund Levin on the show, and we'll be talking about his terrific book, A Child of Christian Blood, Murder and Conspiracy in Tsarist Russia, The Bayless Blood Libel. Now, I think probably many of our listeners will think that the OJ trial was the trial of the century. Not true. The trial of the century happened very early on, and it was, in fact, the Bayless case. I don't really exactly remember when the Dreyfus trial was. Do you remember, Edmund?
Yeah, the Dreyfus trials were in the late 1890s.
Yes, so they don't count.
I want to say thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me. By the way,
yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
I'm a big fan, and it's great to be here.
Yeah.
So the Dreyfus case was in the late 1890s, and the trials were not public.
Oh yeah.
So
okay.
They were behind closed doors.
Go.
So really, even the Dreyfus case is not competition for trials of the century in the sense of a public trial.
Right. So on chronological grounds and on the grounds that it was not public, the Dreyfus case is out, and that leaves us with the Bayless case, which you've done a marvelous job of describing. It was a cause célèbre at the time. Everybody knew about it all over the world because it was, I just want to use the word, outrageous what was going on, and people recognized it as such. Well, actually, it's just very interesting in many ways, especially given what happened to Bayless after it was over. It's kind of a sad story. But so let me say welcome to the show, Edmund. And could you, kick off the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Okay. Well, yeah, let tell you a little bit about myself. It was kind of a long and winding road to writing this book. I've had a long interest in Russia. I studied at the Harriman Institute in the 1980s. I got a degree there. Know Russian pretty well. Then I actually work in television. I work at Good Morning America, the ABC morning news program, as a writer and producer, and I've worked there for many, many years. So I'm basically in television journalism. Then I came to write this book.
Mm-hmm. How do you sleep? By the way, I mean, writing a book, you know.
Sometimes I do. Luckily, I generally do not. A lot of people have to get up really early in the morning to do the show, but I don't. I usually work until 10 or 11 at night, and then I go into work in the afternoon. So I'm not one of those people who has to get up at 3 in the morning.
Right. Right.
Which was kind of good for my writing schedule.
Yeah, but to hold down a full-time job in a job like that and write a book like this, that must have been difficult.
I have to say, yeah, it was pretty difficult. You can ask my family. There's some of them in here, and I can put them on the line to complain. it required for me an unusual amount of discipline. I really had to get up in the morning and work on it, and go to work and come back and work on it. And I kind of wrote in a kind of fever, and I'm not quite sure how I did it.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, there's nothing.
We're glad you did it.
But it's there. I have it in front of me. I definitely did it.
Yes.
So it's an object.
Well, that's terrific.
I have the object, not the kilobytes of the Kindle edition, but mm-hmm. the actual book in front of me, so I know it's solid. It exists.
Right. I've got it, too. So tell us why you wrote a book about the Bayless case.
Why did I write a book about the Bayless case? I wrote it, I've always, as a writer, and I've written quite a few articles for publications like, Slate and the Washington Post, et cetera, and Atlantic Monthly. And like many writers, I have always wanted to write a book and, had that urge. And I thought it might be something about Russia. I was looking around for it, and I sort of decided at some point, you have to get going on writing a book. I want to write a book. I liked narrative. I liked the challenge of writing a narrative. And it actually goes back to my grandmother. Who grew up in Russia at the, what is now Ukraine. maybe Russia someday, who knows, again. But at the point in time, it was part of the Russian Empire. She grew up in the Shtetl in the early 20th century, late 19th century. And she would talk about the Bayless case. Now, I should say the Bayless case, there may be some people out there who have not heard of it. Mendel Bayless was a man who was put on trial in 1913 for killing a child to obtain his blood, the so-called blood libel. And as he said, it was a huge cause celeb, famous all over the world. But we'll talk about that a little later. So I came to write the book because I was thinking about a subject for a book, maybe something about Russia. I know Russian pretty well, as I said. And my grandmother, I really first heard about it from my grandmother, Bluma. And she would talk about, you know, all the horrors of Tsarist Russia, being a Jew in Tsarist Russia. And I remember at one point she said, at the end of a round of stories around the dinner table, she said, "And Mendel Bayless," with a kind of look in her eye, as if that kind of summed it all up. You know, a Jew on trial for, you know, getting blood from a Christian child to make matzah, that kind of summed up all that was bad about Tsarist Russia. So when I said, "Oh, Bayless, okay, I know a little bit about it, but let me see what's out there." And I found that there are two things. One, I felt, I mean, surprisingly little had been written about it. I read there are only really two books, one in English by Maurice Samuel, which is a very good book, and one written in Russian in the 1930s by a man named Alexander Tagar, a very important book, had a lot of primary sources in it, written in the early 1930s. Not really a book for amateurs, but had a lot of information in it, and I found it, you know, fascinating and wondered, well, why isn't more written about this? And I just say, in the academic literature, there is very little written. There's really a great article written by the great historian Hans Rogger. In some ways, actually, I think has not been surpassed, written in the 1960s, about the Bayless case. Wonderful article, but it's not a book that tells the whole story. So I decided I wanted to tell the story from beginning to end, which really nobody had done based on primary sources. And I should say, I looked at the transcript now. The transcript is available. It's actually online. And I read the two books, and then I looked at the transcript, and it is just the most amazing document. You know, there were very few, it's a unique document because in Tsarist Russia, trials were generally not transcribed. The 34-day trial was transcribed as part of a private effort by Russian newspaper, Kievskoye Novosti, Kiev Thought, or Kiev Opinion, as I translated in the book. And it's, I think, 1,200 pages of double-spaced, dense text. And it's just like it's hard to read. It's just, you can just come to it cold. But if you know a little bit about the case, I mean, it's like reading a Dostoevsky or a Gogol or a Dickensian novel. You know, there's just this parade of characters who just, you know, just grab me, on a gut level. And then I looked, poked around further, and I found out that the Kiev State Archive, the Gosudarstvennoye arhiv Kievskoye oblasti, GAKO, had put out a couple of years ago through Eastview Press thousands of documents on microfilm about the case. All the case files, all police reports. So there was a trove of material that it was important to me that it be available here because, well, I did go to Kiev and do research there, but it was important that it was accessible here because I didn't have all that much time to go. I spent some time there, but I couldn't spend months there in the library. So it was just great that all this material is out there and no one had used it. I just felt that this was a fascinating story, in itself, just as a narrative. And also, my bigger aim, I think, is that by telling the story, it creates a kind of portrait of the era, of the time, of this fraught era in Russian history that takes place between 1911 and 1913, when everybody felt that something bad was going to happen. You know, as you probably know, as you know, are informed, those who know people, from the right to the left, they use these metaphors like we're living on the edge of a volcano. Mm-hmm. And everybody felt something was going to happen, bad was going to happen, and people felt that the Bayless case was part of that, part of the sense of doom of that era. So that's pretty much why I wrote the book.
It is interesting that there are so few books on the Bayless case and there are so many books on the Dreyfus Affair. I mean, there's a library full of books on the Dreyfus Affair in English.
Right. I actually, maybe I can just turn the table on you for a moment. I that still puzzles me. And I don't understand why. I mean, I am not an academic historian. You know, I decided to take on this, this primary sources task. But it really mystifies me as to why there's not at least one. You know, you could do a, you know, why an academic historian has not done a full book on the Bailiff case. Recently, Robert Weinberg of Swarthmore, he did a collection of documents, I think published last year on the Bailiff case and on the 100th anniversary of the case with a narrative, kind of introduction to the section. But there's no book, there's no book in English. There's no book in Russian either, on the Bailiff case, using primary sources, telling the story from beginning to end. I really do find it mystifying.
Yeah, I don't know. But, I mean, I really can't. I personally can't explain it except to say that there are a lot more people that study France than study Russia. I think
that's true. But it was so important at the time. There's actually, in general, kind of a one story point out. There's kind of a dearth of writing about the right wing, the Black Hundreds, dearth of academic writing on them at that that era. So maybe it all kind of feeds into each other. It seems to be not much interest in the Black Hundreds, even though I think they're pretty important academically, and maybe that's part of it as well.
Yeah. So let's get right into the material. First of all, I want you to, if you can, explain what blood libel is specifically, and a little bit about the history of blood libel claims.
Okay, the blood libel. Okay, the blood libel is the idea that Jews need the blood of Christians, usually Christian children, although not always, for some kind of ritual or sometimes medicinal purposes. There are various versions. The blood libel, you know, it's funny. We sometimes, what surprised me about, and I didn't know much about the history of the blood libel when I began writing the book, what surprises me, you know, is that historians can really pinpoint, you know, how it developed and where it came from. You know, we sometimes talk about ancient hatreds and things like that as if they've always been there, you know. But this was an idea that was invented by people that did not exist at one point and existed suddenly at another point. And historians can trace the origins of the blood libel to England in the mid-12th century. The first ritual accusation of ritual murder was recorded by a Welsh monk named Thomas of Monmouth about the murder of a Christian boy, William of Norwich. This is kind of a proto blood libel. It wasn't quite the full story, but the basic idea was that the Jews had killed this boy for ritual purposes. And then in the subsequent decades, the ritual murder charge became elaborated into the version, kind of the most standard version. I should say, moved from England to the continent, to France and Germany, and the story became elaborated into the mainline version, which is that Jews kill Christian children, usually young children, to obtain their blood to make matzah. Now, that is the main version. There is a Purim version, which is another Jewish holiday, the idea that Jews bake it, use blood to make hamantaschen, which is the pastry that Jews eat
Very tasty.
Purim.
Very tasty.
Yeah, tasty. And there are a lot of other weird ideas. It was an idea that Jewish men menstruate and need blood to replenish their energy. That's the weirder version. But the matzah version became the main version, and that is indeed the version that Bayliss was tried on. Let me say a little more about the blood libel. Is that it kind of came and went. It was most virulent probably between, I guess, the mid 1300s to the mid 1500s. Then really faded in Western Europe. Was more common in Poland, but until the late 19th century, between the mid-1500s and the late 1900s, there weren't too many cases in Western Europe. In Western Europe, only really more common in Eastern Europe, and not even that many cases in Russia Russia either.
Mm-hmm.
But the blood libel is just incredibly persistent. You know, you go on the internet, it's still there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has not died out.
Mm-hmm. So let's put this in religious context just very quickly. And in religious context, that, with Jews, that means the Jewish Bible and the Talmud. And it's very clear that all kinds of laws in Judaism, and that's what Judaism is about, say you can't do that under any circumstances.
Right. I mean, one of the main prescriptions in Judaism, in the halachic that they call law, is that you cannot consume blood. I mean, all kinds of efforts are made with their kosher meat to drain the meat of blood. You cannot. I mean, that is, if you. I mean, it's often been pointed out. You know, you could not think of a more outrageous claim than to say the Jews drink blood, because the law is so clear that you cannot do that.
Yeah, and not just human blood, but any blood. Blood is out.
Any blood, even your own blood. I know there are very complex rules. Like, I was looking in the Talmud and commentaries on it. You know what happens if you cut your cut your lip and blood gets on something you're eating, and all kinds. I don't recall the exact rules, but I mean it shows that there's a lot of tremendous consciousness about consuming blood and avoiding it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it is a strange charge.
Mm-hmm. And another thing, I think I remember this, that even early on, and I don't know about the 12th century, but certainly by the early modern era, mainstream Christian authorities, including the Pope, were saying that these accusations were ridiculous.
Yeah, actually, from the very beginning, I believe in 1247, Pope Innocent IV, the popes condemned the blood libel. The Catholic Church, I mean, there's kind of a strange contradiction here. I mean, the blood libel emerged in Catholic Western Europe. There were no Protestants then. And I think that even after the rise of Protestantism, it remained mainly a Catholic phenomenon with deeper roots in Catholic Europe than in Protestant Europe. But the popes, a number of popes, Innocent IV, I believe, was the first, then there were a number of others, condemned the blood libel. They said, you know, don't make this charge. So it was never officially vetted by, officially promulgated by the Catholic Church, or really by any church.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about its history in the Russian Empire. I like the part of the book where you say, well, there were blood libel cases, and the government reacted differently to them at different times.
Yeah, I mean, there were a number of blood libel cases in Russia in the 19th century. All of them, with one kind of with one exception in the 1850s, that did not get very much closer at the time, ended in acquittals. But it wasn't. You know, we might tend to think. You know, I think. Russia. They're all a bunch of. You know, it was very innocent at the time. They didn't like Jews. Well, of course, you know. Why wouldn't they accuse Jews of the blood libel? But really, cases were relatively uncommon, and until the Bayless case, they were local affairs. As the great historian John Clear pointed out, historian of Jews in Russia, you know, the blood libel is a Western phenomenon, and in Russia it really had rather shallow roots, you know, in terms religiously. So there were blood libel cases. There was one in Saratov in the 1850s, having to do with a couple of Jewish soldiers. There was one in Georgia in the 1870s. There were a couple others, but none of them gained the notoriety, worldwide attention that the Bayless case did.
Well, one interesting thing about I'm laughing because about. When we think of Russia as this very anti-Semitic place, and maybe like it always has been, but actually it does have very shallow roots, because there were no Jews in early modern Russia.
Right.
None.
Jews came in. Right. The Jews, there were no Jews. There were Judaizers, right? But no Jews.
Yeah. No Jews. So.
And I bet you can still have anti-Semitism, you know, without.
Oh, they Jews. Did. They did. There's even a book about it. By a guy I know. And they did have anti-Semitism.
Right.
But it was extraordinarily abstract, because...
Right, abstract, yeah. So they needed real Jews. Putting somebody, a Jew, on trial, you need a real live Jew.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So anyway, I've lost my read here? Where are
we? Well, we were talking about the Blood Libel cases that preceded the Bayless case, but let's jump right to the Bayless case.
Right.
Was it the feeling among, I guess, the intelligentsia and the government, at least in Russia, that you know, by 1913, that these things were just a thing of the past, that they were over?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is the thing that there had been actually. I mean, there were horrific blood libel cases. The most recent one had been in Vilnius of a man named Blondus, who was eventually, through a very torturous process, he was acquitted. But I mean, these cases were local affairs, there had in Russia. I mean, what distinguished the Bayless case was that it was backed by the central government, mm-hmm. by the regime. Unambiguously, mm-hmm. This is what distinguished it, and I think yes, people. As I said, you know, I think that maybe you are more sophisticated, and we have a sophisticated audience here. You know, a lot of people think that well, Russia, you know, as I said, anti-Semitic. There are a bunch of anti-Semites. You know, they were inciting pogroms. You know, of course, they put a Jew on trial for the blood libel. But you know, as people might know, it's a misconception to think that. The regime, well, it was definitely anti-Semitic. There were 1,400 regulations regulating Jews, where they could live, what professions they could have, and it was a very anti-Semitic place, the most anti-Semitic place on earth, you could say, at the time. But the regime was not going around encouraging hatred or violence against Jews, quite the opposite, as you know, recent scholarship, or really scholarship in the last, you know, couple of decades has established pretty conclusively. So, you know, you asked, well, did people think this was a thing in the past? I think the thing, the answer to that is yes, is that to kind of understand the Bayless case, especially if you are not a specialist and may kind of think you know something about the atmosphere of the time and how anti-Semitic it was, you need to kind of rid yourself of some of your preconceptions. In that the state was not sponsoring pogroms. At the time, the priority was the preservation of order, mm-hmm. and they did not want violence against Jews. Mm-hmm. So people on the most progressive of virulent anti-proponents of the regime were shocked that the state would put a Jew on trial on this ridiculous charge. One of Bayless' attorneys, he became his attorney, his name was one of these forgotten figures, what I call the losers of Russian history who have been forgotten. And that's actually part of what I like about the book is that you kind of learn about the losers who have been forgotten, people, extraordinary people whose stories are not been told.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, and we tend to focus on the winners. So there's a man named Vasily Maklakov. He was a parliament member, a very brilliant man, one of Bayless' attorneys, prominent member of the Cadet Party. And, you know, he said about the Bayless case, he said, this is a sign of an internal illness afflicting the state itself. I mean, this is someone who hated the regime, and he just could not believe this happened. And he saw this as a really bad sign that the regime was even worse than he thought.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So let's get right into the case itself, and let's talk about the victim here. Well, actually, there are a number of victims. Person who was murdered, Andrei Yushinsky, that was his name, right?
Right.
Did I remember that right?
Andrei, right, perfect pronunciation. You got it.
Yeah. Okay. So Andrei Yushinsky was killed. He was killed in 19. He was murdered in 1911 and found in like a culvert or something. And take it from there.
Yeah, let me take it. I think, you know, I always say, your number talks about the case. I always like to remember, talk about the victim. I think Andrei Yushinsky is important. I mean, in these blood libel cases, there is always a victim, a real victim. Occasionally there were cases where there was no victim, but they kind of invented a victim and the body didn't even exist. But in most cases, there is a real victim, a real person, usually a child who was killed and who never got justice because he or she the murder was blamed on an innocent Jew as opposed to finding the real killers. So Andrei Yushinsky was a 13-year-old boy, poor, abused at home by his, he lived with a step family. He was illegitimate. His mother managed to marry a man, but she was very poorly treated. And he was, thanks to the help of an aunt, he was getting an education. He was studying to become a priest at a religious school. And he decided to play hooky one day and to visit a friend of his named Zhenya Chibriak, who was the happened to be the son of a notorious gang leader in Kiev. And he went back to his old neighborhood of Lukianovka, and he disappeared. This was in the March of 1911. And a few days later, couple of gymnasium students were roaming around the outskirts of Kiev, rather disreputable place, where there were caves. And they were going on this kind of adventurous jaunt. And one of the boys dared the other to go into the cave to see what was in there. Now, you know, one was too afraid. One said he would go in. And he found Andrei's body, which was covered with about 50 stab wounds. There's some dispute about the number. The official count was 47. Could have been a little more. But he was had been horribly murdered. So immediately, the hue and cry went up that the Jews killed this boy. And the Black Hundreds, the right-wing movement of the time, the local chapter of, called the Union of Russian People, the Black Hundred organization, it was called the Double-Headed Eagle, that was the name of the organization, they began agitating that a Jew must have killed this boy. And they actually distributed leaflets at Andrei's funeral, saying that the Yids had killed him for their Passover.
Mm-hmm. Can I step in with a question right there?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and that is that presumably there were lots of children that died in Kiev or were murdered in Kiev pretty regularly. I'm not saying that there were one every day,
yeah,
but
sure.
There were certainly multiple ones every year. Did they do this every time a child got killed?
You know, that's an interesting question. I did not come across any murders that were ascribed to Jews. I think in Kiev around that time, there were a couple later after the Bales case began where they pointed to Jews as perpetrators.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think that the murder, perhaps because of its grotesque, awful character, may have given them. Given them the idea of blaming this on the Jews.
Yeah, and that makes a certain amount of sense because the body was mutilated, and their minds might wander in that direction. So,
right. No.
Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No. His body is found. There's this tremendous agitation over his murder, and now this is in March. And what I found interesting was the very indirect path the case took toward charging a Jew. The state did not immediately decide to charge a Jew with a crime. Again, at this point in Tsarist Russia, there was tremendous concern over not inciting any kind of disorder. And, that's the contradiction of this, because I think historians have struggled with this. People have worked on it. Hans Rogger struggled with it, with this idea of, the state at this point wants to tam things down. After the 1905 revolution, there was enormous disorder. By 1911, things had quieted down. They wanted to keep things that way. So why you think that putting a Jew on trial and something which could incite violence, activity that could be really detrimental to the regime, to its stability, why would they go and do that? I think that is the kind of the mystery of the Bayless case that I'm not sure anybody has quite solved. But what you can see in the record is the tremendous hesitance of the state to charge a Jew with a crime. At first, they let the state, I think in May or so, late April, May, the justice minister sent one of his minions to Kiev to look around and to see what was going on with the investigation. A man named Lyada was his name, Alexander Lyada. And you can see from the record that he definitely pushed investigators in the direction of, at this early stage, of charging a Jew with a crime. He basically said, you know, find a Jew. What's interesting is that several months after that point, the center government kind of laid off and let the investigators pursue the investigation the way they thought. And what's interesting is that not a single police official thought a Jew had committed the crime. They first investigated the family, which is actually what you would normally do. You know, when you see a crime like this, abused child, stepfather, troubled home, you look at the family. Although they went way too far and arrested the family really with no good cause, and that did their credibility a lot of damage. And that gave the Black Hundreds trash to say, look, these guys are completely incompetent. But then the state they brought in a guy named Nikolai Krasovsky, who was known at some point as Kiev Sherlock Holmes or Russia Sherlock Holmes, very canny, wily investigator. And they let him pursue the case pretty much the way he wanted. And he did not think that a Jew had committed the crime. So it took quite a few months, really until July, that's about 4 or 5 months, for the state to decide to charge a Jew. And, you know, with all the hesitance, when they decided to charge a Jew, they really went, you know, full bull, pulled out all the stops, and arrested Mendel Bayless, this poor man, for this crime. And maybe I'll say a little bit about him.
Yeah, and say a little bit, but yes, actually tell us about Bayless, who seems like a pretty good guy.
Yeah, so Mendel Bayless, you know, what I think is kind of valuable about the book is, what I like about the story is its sweep. You know, you get from high to low, you know, you get a portrait of different class of society. You get the Romanovs, you get the officials in the government, you get poor people like Andrei Yashinsky. And then there are people like Bayless, and he gives a little bit of a portrait of what it's like to be a Jew at this time. Bayless was kind of an average, in a way you could call it, Russian Jew. Russian Jew is a term that really came about, and you didn't talk about Russian Jews, Ruski Yudei, until the mid to late 19th century. The idea that you could be Russian and Jewish was kind of a new idea then. And Bayless was a typical Russian Jew. He was born outside of Kiev, and he came to Kiev to for a better life for his family. He worked in a brick factory as a clerk and dispatcher. He had five children, and he worked for a the owner of the factory was a very rich man, and there were rich Jews then. His name was Jonas Zaitsev. He was a beet sugar magnate. Kiev was something of a beet boomtown. It was based on sugar beets, sugar-backed securities. And so Bayless worked in this factory, which was interestingly, the profits from the factory, it tells you a lot about the time. Zaitsev founded this factory so the profits would go to support a charitable hospital for people of all faiths. And the hospital was interestingly founded in honor, in the 1890s, in honor of the marriage of Nicholas and Alexandra. And the idea was these Jewish grandees were trying to show they were loyal Russian Jews, loyal subjects of the Tsar. So Bayless worked in this factory as a clerk and dispatcher, you know, worked all 14-hour days, carts of bricks would come by, he'd fill out the receipts. And he also served in the Russian army for about 5 years, got an honorable discharge. And so he was a loyal Russian Jew. And, you know, for his trouble, he was arrested in the middle of the night in July 1911 and put in jail for 2.5 years, awaiting, in horrible conditions, awaiting a trial on this insane charge. And I should say, now, why was Bayless, why did they pick Bayless?
Right.
Only reason he was charged. There was no evidence, literally no evidence. You know, in some cases there is evidence, you know, but, or some kind of evidence, you can say, well, there's something there. There's absolutely no evidence. The only reason he was charged was that he was the Jew who lived closest to the scene of the crime. The brick factory, his office, home office, was a few hundred yards from the cave where Andrei's body was found. And that was really the only reason He was charged as a suspect. He was really a poor fit. He was a proud Jew, but not a very religious one. He went to synagogue once a year. You know, we often talk about, Jews here talk about how people are falling off on their observance. But, you know, it was similar then, you know. He went for high holy days. He worked on Saturday, on the Sabbath. I said, you know, he certainly felt very Jewish, but was not a very observant Jew.
Mm-hmm.
Did not look like a Jew that you'd want to, if you were going to pick a perpetrator. He didn't have payuses. He didn't look,
right.
Didn't dress in traditional Jewish garb.
Right.
So
they arrest him.
That's a little bit of Mendel Bayless.
Right. They arrest him and they charge him. And the charge, if I understand correctly, had to be approved from the very highest levels, right?
Yeah. I mean, that is what distinguishes this case, is that it was backed at the very highest levels by the Justice Minister, Ivan Shiglovita, and the Interior Minister, McLaughlin, who was, interestingly enough, the brother of one of Bayless's attorneys, which shows you the splits in the society. So it had to be approved at the very highest levels, yes. It was guided and directed at the very highest levels.
Why did they decide to do this? I mean, can you speculate? It just seems so out of character with the regime at that time. And the regime, as you say, was still in shock after what had happened in 1905. They were really hoping to avoid any kind of conflict, and you know, particularly in that area. But why would they choose to do this?
You know, I think that you know, it still is a mystery. And I think that I know that Hans Rogger, he actually, he wrote in his Great Historian, he wrote a book that I read an obituary that he wrote a full-length book about the Bayless case, but destroyed the manuscript because he felt it didn't come up to his standards. So clearly there's something about the case that confounds people. I think that to me, it's funny, I a historian that was very kind enough to read parts of the book and comment on it. You know, he said he liked what I had written, but he said, well, you know, you focus a little bit more on personalities than I would, you know, I guess as an academic historian, and I guess as a non-academic, I do focus on personalities. But I think it may be the right way to go. I really think that it comes down, I mean, there are two ways you can look at it. I mean, I would say, trying to use a parsimonious explanation, I think it comes down to the Tsar, to Nicholas. Nicholas II was anti-Semitic. Of course, all his ministers were probably anti-Semitic to some degree or another. He was more anti-Semitic than they were in a way that really shocked them. There was, around this time, a year or two earlier, there was a project to alleviate the burdens on Jews, alleviate these restrictive regulations. And it was presented to Nicholas, and he took several weeks or months to consider it. And he came back and he said, and these are rather minor alleviations, but he's well known in the, you know, we know well known in the histories. He came back and he said, wrote that, his inner voice commanded him, you know, not to alleviate the situation of the Jews. And, you know, he said, you know, his my inner voice has never, and I believe the word never is in italics, is underlined. My inner voice has never misled me.
Oh, boy.
And his ministers were really, really surprised. And I think it was Kakav Tsok, who later became prime minister. You know, he said, he pointed to that as a kind of a signpost, a signal that he just was off the rails. One kind of, you know, theory is that we don't know his exact role. There are signs in the documents that he followed the case pretty closely because he marked up stuff that he read. And there's one document where, you know, his mark is there. When he would go through and he would put a slanted line and flanked by two dots. So he was clearly reading about the case, reading documents, internal documents. My basic theory is that his ministers felt this kind of thing would please him. You know, indeed, the way the case turned out, everybody was rewarded, you know, who was involved, even though the verdict, as we'll get to, was mixed. Everybody was rewarded, so they were right. So I think basically they thought he would like this. Mm-hmm. Hans Rogger, you know, he put it a little bit, and also Richard Workman, you know, great historian, put it a little differently, but along the same lines. I mean, Rogger said that, you know, as he was kind of grappling with this, he said that, you know, no purely rational explanation of the Bayliss case, quote unquote, and he quoted it, quote unquote, makes sense. You know, that there's really, that he, as he said, he saw it as an attempt to supply ingredients for a missing faith. I mean, he was really reaching for a kind of non-rational, kind of unconscious explanation.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, it takes a little bit of imagination to think this way, and maybe historians aren't comfortable, most historians wouldn't be comfortable in kind of trying to get their heads in other people's heads in that way, but I think he may be onto something, because it's hard to find a rational explanation. As he said, you know, there was an attempt to kind of, you know, the search for a principle to rally the forces of monarchism. Not that they were saying, oh, we are going to, and this is what some historians will find this, they kind of simplify and say, well, yeah, they were trying to rouse the rabble, you know, get people behind the regime, but they really weren't trying to rouse the rabble. You know, maybe they were kind of trying to buck themselves up, you know, mentally, as well as please the czar. Richard Workman, you know, kind of playing off Rogger, you know, he sees this case as a way for, the czar, he saw Russia as a non-Western country. And even, you know, wasn't so crazy about Peter the Great for putting Russia on the wrong path.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had a kind of obsession with the 17th century. And Workman, you know, sees this case as a way for Nicholas and for the regime to define themselves as non-Western. You know, I mean, this is about the notes, you know, this is a way to show, you know, we are following our own path. So there's no, I think, entirely satisfactory explanation. But one thing it does show is how far the regime is off the rails, I think.
Yeah. I liked what you said about trying to show that they are not European, is the way I would put it. That makes a certain amount of sense to me.
Right. Not in Europe. That's a better way of putting it, although you could say the blood libel comes from Europe, and they'll talk about a little bit about that later. Obviously, anti-Semitism was a European phenomenon, but I think that for Russians, the idea for the regime was a way, you know, as Workman argued, it was a way of drawing a line between, you know, between Russia and Europe.
Right. I mean, I think the right context for this, in terms of Nicholas's perception, or one of the contexts, is, again, the Dreyfus Affair, which he, of course, remembered, and he saw what happened to the French authorities as a result of it. They were discredited in the eyes of world opinion, and he may have thought to himself, well, that's really what we want. We want to be discredited people's eyes, because we're not like them.
Yeah, and I think they're you know, trying to show that that's what we want. We want to be like that.
Yeah, yeah, right. Hard to believe, though, that is, you know.
It was kind of an act of, it's an act of Russian, the case was an act of Russian self-definition.
Well, you know, the Russians are still doing things like this. I know just the other day Putin said that there could no longer be any swearing on TV or in films.
Right. they're still doing it, and there are continuities. So you know, whether unconsciously or probably unconsciously, it was a way of, you know, showing that Russia was following a non-European path. Although in the century, the European path took a turn, took an anti-Semitic turn.
Yeah. So let's follow Bayliss a little bit. So they throw him in jail, and then a long time transpires, 2 years. What happens in that 2 years?
Yeah, so, I mean, again, it shows there are a couple of reasons. I mean, again, the kind of haphazard course I found really interesting. The state was still hesitant about charging him with the blood libel. And in the first indictment, was handed out, and he was arrested in July. The first indictment was handed out in July, in January 1912, several months later, and it did not accuse him directly of using of killing the Shah for Christian Guadalupe, there were kind of hints in there. So it seemed at that point the state was, you know, trying him and kind of letting people read between the lines rather than explicitly charging him with a blood libel. In fact, the defense, you know, when they moved to draw up a list of witnesses, they wanted experts on religion. And the judge said, well, this case isn't about religion. You know, I'm not going to let you call witnesses on the Jewish religion. It was only a year later, more over a year later, with a second indictment, that the state explicitly made the charge that this was a ritual murder and really decided, essentially, to put the Jewish religion on trial. So it took a very, it took a long time. I think two reasons. One is that the state was deciding how they were going to, what kind of charges they would bring. And the other is that there was kind of a big investigation in the press of the case that forced the state to reassess the case and come up with a new line of attack.
Mm-hmm. So while the judicial authorities are honing their accusation, the investigative authorities are concluding that Bayless didn't do it.
Yeah, it's very clear in the secret communications, no one believes he's guilty. They believed that the most likely suspect was a woman named Vera Chibryak, who is an amazingly villainous character, the most seductive villain you'll ever encounter. And she was the head of a criminal gang, as I think I said earlier. And her son, Zhenya, was the victim, Andrei Yashinsky's best friend. And the leading theory is that Andrei was killed because he saw too much of what Vera and her gang were doing. The state knew full well about this theory, believed it was very possibly correct. And you see, you know, high officials corresponding with each other, you know, and there's absolutely no indication they think they're all guilty. It's all about Vera Chibryak. And it really is, you know, kind of shocking.
Mm-hmm.
It's cynicism of it.
So when they, after they indict him and when they put him on trial, once the trial starts, could you enumerate just what sorts of evidence, that's in air quotes, the prosecutors adduced to show that Bayless did it?
Yeah, there really was, strictly speaking, there was no evidence. I mean, they had testimony of, you know, drunks who could barely make it to the witness stand, criminals like Vera Chibryak, but I guess let me back up. There were several cases. There was no physical evidence linking him to the crime. So the state essentially relied on perjured, bribed testimony, and expert testimony that was very dubious. So I'll just give you some of the highlights. I mean, one of the expert witnesses was a man named Ivan Sikorsky. He was a very eminent psychiatrist, a really world-renowned, and his papers were cited. His son, Igor Sikorsky, is better known. He was the inventor of the helicopter,
yes,
who eventually ended up in the United States. But his father was a very eminent guy. He was also a little senile. And he fancied himself an expert on the Jewish religion, on Jewish practices, and today we would call him a psychological profiler. I suppose, and he said that this crime was typical of the vendetta of the sons of Jacob. In other words, that the Jews must have committed it. Other witnesses, they had a pathologist who was who testified that the wounds were inflicted to drain blood, which was totally preposterous because they were he wanted to drain blood from somebody. He stabbed somebody 50 times. As the defense expert pointed out, you'd open a vein. You know, one vein, maybe, not 50. So it was just—it was a very ineffective. You know, the blood was all over the place. There was no way to collect it. It was just—you know—it was a massacre. So this pathologist, though, he was paid. He was literally bribed by the head, the chief of the National Department of Police, Stepan Bilevsky. Literally, the guy, you know, was stuffing thousands of rubles into his pockets before he testified. So he was paid to say what the state wanted. And then there is, you know, Vera Chibryak, who's just this most amazing character. You know, I'd love to see an actress play on the screen. I mean, just she was head of a criminal gang. She was a notorious figure in Lucana, in this neighborhood. She was married to a civil servant, had three children, but had this other life as a criminal. And a few years earlier, she had many lovers. And a few years earlier, and this is the kind of stuff you just can't make up, she had a French musician lover, and she blinded him with sulfuric acid in some kind of lover's quarrel. He refused to testify against her. She was acquitted, and their acquaintanceship continued after that. After he was blinded, they called him the blind musician.
Mm-hmm.
And she would take him to the French consulate to get his invalid's pension. Because of that, she had blinded him. And Virginie Briac ended up as the star witness for the prosecution. So this absolute psychopath, I mean, I guess the term is out of fashion, but I would call it criminally insane, ended up as the star witness of the state.
Mm-hmm.
She perjured herself, claimed that her children had seen Bayless grab the boy, grab Andrei Shinsky and drag him off. And she got her young daughter to perjure herself on the stand and make up this story about seeing Bayless do that.
Mm-hmm.
Just speaking of personalities and why I think maybe, the personalities are important, I think the fact that the state would conspire with a criminal sociopath, and you're talking about the highest officials, you're talking about the Minister of the Interior, the Minister of Justice, the fact that they would conspire with a criminal sociopath, I think tells you a lot about the regime and how it worked. And I think you read the book, and I hope you get a sense, like I said, of kind of how the place worked, you know, and this is how it worked, and it really is kind of astonishing.
Mm-hmm. And they call an expert on blood libel. It's a Catholic priest, right? Do I recall this correctly?
Yeah, the so-called
expert, quote unquote. Yeah,
they could not find, interestingly enough, a reputable Orthodox, Russian Orthodox theologian.
I was going to ask about just that. Yeah, just why couldn't they? I mean, what did the Orthodox Church say about all this, or did they say anything?
The Orthodox Church, as you know, Orthodox Church is very subservient to the state throughout its history. They didn't have a whole lot to say. There weren't Orthodox priests, pronouncing from the pulpit. There were some articles that probably two people saw, which declaring Bayless to be guilty in the religious publications, but really didn't play a big role in the case. There were a few theologians who actually came out in his defense, but the church did not play a big role. So, but anyway, they couldn't find a. We have to assume that they would have loved to have had a Russian Orthodox theologian testify that Jews, about the blood libel, but they couldn't find one. I would assume. So they got this decrepit Catholic priest in Tashkent, Justin Pernitis, who had written a number of pseudo-scholarly books about the Jews and their nefariousness. And he was a very disreputable character. He had once he had committed art fraud, trying to pass off a painting as an old master. I was caught, and he was not jailed, but he was exiled. I think Petersburg, Tashkent, get him out of the way. And then he comes back because, he's the only guy they can find. And he was just, the defense showed him to be entirely ignorant of Jewish texts. So his testimony was a fiasco.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the testimony of, there were drunks. There were a couple of, with a couple who the state at first got to kind of implicate Bayless, but then they retracted their testimony and, to their credit. And, their testimony was also a disaster.
Mm-hmm. So who
it was just a parade of drunks, lunatics, senile guys like Sikorsky. The case is just a fiasco.
Uh-huh. Who did the defense call?
The defense, they called a number of people. Although, interestingly, in the Russian court system, there were no strictly speaking witnesses for the defense and prosecution. There were only witnesses for the state. It was kind of very confusing and kind of disorganized. The state called a number of experts on the Jewish religion, Orthodox theologians. They called witnesses in Bayless' defense. Very heroic man named a shoemaker named Mikhail Nakhonyechny, who who just pointed the finger at one of the perjured witnesses against Bayless and said he was lying. Very heroic, very eloquent man. And a number of other people who testified as to Bayless's character.
Mm-hmm. So it's time to go to the jury. Who was the jury? Who was on the jury?
The jury, okay, you know, the Russian justice system was probably the most best functioning part, most Western style part of the system. You know, the 1864 reforms created a pretty good court system. They had discovery procedures. They had, you had to know what the witnesses were going to say pretty much before they took the stand. And the jury, they had 12 people in the jury. They were mostly peasants. And it's clear that the state tried to keep educated people off the stand. They seemed to believe that peasants would be more easily manipulated. Although it's not clear why they thought that to be the case, given that I think that, peasants were certainly wavering in their support of the regime, but they appeared to believe that uneducated people would be a better bet. So there were about half the jury were peasants, and they had bowl haircuts. You can see the pictures. They were wearing peasant caftans. People remarked on that at the time, that they were amazed at the composition of the jury. So they were mostly peasants and a few civil servants and people like that.
And do you know anything about their political leanings or anything like that?
You know, we know very little about the jury other than their verdict. But we don't really know.
Mm-hmm. So what was the verdict?
Well, the verdict, Bayless, and there were two. The state, hedged its bets. They realized how weak their case was. So there was a notorious double verdict. The state, and it gets a little complicated and it's often mischaracterized. Sometimes it said that the jury was asked to decide whether the murder of Andrei Yashinsky was a ritual murder. That is not quite true. The question was worded to say, was the murder committed in the manner the state says? At the brick factory, with a certain number of glasses of blood drained, a certain number of wounds, a certain number of places. And, there was a broad hint in the wording that this was a crime committed for ritual purposes, but the word ritual or Jew was not used. The second question was, did Bayless commit the crime? So the verdict was split. The jury, on the first question, the jury said, yes, the crime was committed in the manner laid out in the charge, in the manner the prosecution said. This was taken as a victory for the prosecution. People said, slightly inaccurately, that the jury had ruled that the crime was a ritual murder. On the second count, was Bayless guilty or innocent? The jury found he was not guilty. And he was freed. Interestingly, in the Russian jury system, it did not go by unanimous verdict. A 6-6 tie would go to the defendant. A majority, whatever would go, whichever way the verdict went. So yeah, the verdicts were decided by a majority. So.
Mm-hmm.
At least six jurors thought that Bayless was not guilty.
I guess one question I have, I'm not familiar with the Russian legal system at this time, really, but I thought that in order to level a charge against somebody, and that would be a count, there had to be somebody on the other end. So who the first count, which is was the murder accomplished in the way the state said it was, is a count without an object.
You are correct. And indeed,
that's weird.
One of the heroes of the book, of Vladimir, Vladimir Nabokov Sr., who was Vladimir, the novelist's father, who is a prominent cadet figure, journalist, editor of the newspaper Riech or Speech, who did some great reporting on the trial. He made this point. And in fact, it was highly unusual, I believe unprecedented. The defense argued that it's it's prejudicial with a view toward whether Bayless is innocent or guilty. Once he set up the question that way,
right?
They were worried that it would prejudice. I mean, again, they were primarily thinking of the defendant, which is their job. So they argue it was prejudice toward him, and also simply in terms of justice, it's really not defensible. There was really no legal basis. But the judge, who was in the pocket of the state, he approved this kind of hedging their bets, so at least they might win one out of two on the charges.
Right, but then the implication
is to claim victory.
The implication is, though, that the object of this count is the Jewish people.
I think that's an excellent way of putting it, and I think that people said, they're putting the Jewish people on trial.
Yeah.
Even though the state, vociferously said, no, we're not saying all Jews are guilty. We're only saying some fanatics are do this terrible thing. But in fact, it was clear that the whole Jewish people were on trial.
Yeah, right. Well, we're almost out of time, but I really want to talk about what happens to Bayless after the trial, because it's interesting. So could you just briefly tell us what happens to Bayless and his family after the trial?
I will briefly tell you about it. There's one more important point that I didn't work in.
Okay,
I'll
go ahead.
Very briefly before I get to Bayless. I should say that I don't want to pin all this on Russia, because in the late 19th century, and I'll be very brief, there were a bunch of blood libel trials in Western Europe, in Hungary, in Prussia, in Bohemia and elsewhere. So, there's a question as to whether the Bayless case is somehow connected to a wider phenomenon in Europe. But I won't get into that at length. But there were, they were not backed. They were backed by local authorities, not by the central government. But there still were, at the end of the 19th century, there was this puzzling explosion, or mini explosion of blood libel trials and blood libel cases. There were a half dozen trials and a lot of accusations in the press and against Jews.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not only a Russian phenomenon. But the Bayless case does stand out as being the last blood libel trial in Europe and the only one really backed by the central government. But let me go on. Let me answer your question about Bayless. What happened to Bayless? Bayless' estate was, I wish it was a totally happy ending, but it really wasn't. He was acquitted. He decided he wanted to stay stay where he was for a while. He said, I think very bravely, I saw on a newspaper account, he said, I'm going to, he said, I really want to take a rest, but I'm going to stay in Kiev because I don't want to let the Black Hundreds to think I'm afraid. But after a few weeks, he decided it was just too dangerous for him to be there. And his family, they moved to Palestine, which he loved. He loved being in the land of Israel. He had been an urban person his whole life, but loved being in the country. But unfortunately, he had a hard time making a living. As we know now, fame can destroy you. He rejected a lot of lucrative offers to lecture and go on the vaudeville circuit out of a sense of honor. May have been a mistake because he had a hard time making a living. World War I created chaos in Palestine, and eventually he moved to America in 1922, I believe. Was in one business or another, didn't have a lot of success, wrote his memoirs, which sold okay, never quite found his footing in America. He didn't like the pace of America. He always longed to go back, actually, to Israel. He lived in the Bronx and died in 1934. But a lot of people, 4,000 people turned out for his funeral. But after that, he really was forgotten, as we discussed earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So that is what happened to Mendel Bayless.
Yeah. Is the Bayless case remembered in Russia today? Do people know about
it? Yeah. I think that anybody, most Russians will know. Russians know who Mendel Bayless was, Russian Jews especially. Here I find, very people have heard of it.
Yeah.
But it is remembered. There was the 100th anniversary. There was, the trial last year. There was, actually attended a conference in Kiev in last October when things were much quieter, and a conference on the Bayless case and anti-Semitism. All kinds of big people, like former Ukrainian prime minister were there, wow. American ambassador, all saying, the right things about Jews and how prejudice is a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. So, Edmund, thank you so much for talking with us today about your book.
Well, thank you.
It's really a lot of fun. Let me conclude the interview by asking you our traditional final question on the New Books Network, and that is, what are you working on now?
As you pointed out, writing a book with a full-time job is kind of hard to do. I'm just like gearing myself up now to maybe write something else, but I'm looking around. I have some ideas, but I'm looking around for a subject, so I'm not exactly sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's where I am now.
Well, that's good. Not exactly
just
sure.
Going to work every
day. Place
to
be. Yeah, going to work every day is even a better place to be. So let me tell everybody that we've been talking to Edmund Levin about his book, A Child of Christian Blood, Murder and Conspiracy in Tsarist Russia, The Bayless Blood Libel. Edmund, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. And let me say to everyone who listens to this podcast, thank you very much, and I hope you have a great week.